Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the summertime season 2023, and the reading is easy. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing some of the sessions from the 2021 HNSA conference.
The Historical Novels Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000. Divided between the adult and CYA categories.
Our first session is HNSA Chair Elizabeth Storrs in conversation with Geraldine Brooks. This conversation took place before the release of Geraldine's novel, Horse, which was subsequently shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2022.
Welcome all of you again. This is a very special treat, especially for me, because I'm going to be in conversation with Geraldine Brooks. I confess to having a girl crush as I've long admired Geraldine's books. And I imagine none of you need a real introduction to her, but I'm still going to do the honours. I'm delighted Geraldine has joined us. She grew up in Sydney and worked as a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald and the Wall Street Journal, where she covered crises in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. She was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction in 2006 for her novel March. Her novels, Caleb's Crossing and People of the Book, were New York Times bestsellers. Her first novel, Year of Wonders, is an international bestseller, translated into more than 25 languages and currently optioned for a major motion picture starring Andrew Lincoln. Her most recent novel is The Secret Chord. So welcome, Geraldine.
G'day.
So we're going to get started because so many of your books directly address our theme of recovering lost histories. So first of all, Year of Wonders. I'm sure you never thought your debut novel would spark renewed book sales because of its plotline's uncanniness to our modern day pandemic. To recap, the novel is based on a true story of Iam, a 17th century English village where the vicar convinced its citizens to courageously quarantine themselves to contain the spread of the bubonic plague to other rural towns. To my mind, Iam's predicament allowed you to explore the best and worst of human nature when faced with terror, pain, and the unknown. Some villagers showed courage, charity, and understanding, while others descended into the chaos of superstition, hysteria, and intolerable cruelty. If you were writing the book today, would you have changed anything, having now lived through a pandemic and lockdown yourself?
Wow, that's such an interesting question. I don't think so, is the very incomplete answer. So I wrote that book not knowing if I could actually write a novel at all. I was just taking a swan dive off the ledge when I started writing that book. My life until then had been as a journalist, a foreign correspondent, covering modern day catastrophes in Iraq and Sarajevo and various other places. But I had witnessed what the stress of catastrophe does to people and how they're changed by it and how their reactions can be so incredibly varied, and how some people are drawn to their best self and find a heroism and a generosity of spirit that maybe they never would have known they possessed if this terrible thing hadn't happened to them. And then other people I had witnessed become completely morally lost and turn into torturers and ruthless killers and completely self-interested, just, evil. So that was what I was trying to explore, using the story of Im as the vehicle to do it. So I was taking actual examples that I'd seen in the covering of contemporary catastrophes and running those examples up against the possibilities for the kinds of people who lived in the village of Im. And the interesting thing about that village is there's so very little contemporary written material. So you really have to extrapolate from very thin historical gruel, because most of the people who lived in the village weren't literate, so they didn't get to set down the facts of what it was like to be there during that year of quarantine. So I think I would probably, as a historical novelist, still write it the same way. But what's been interesting living through our contemporary plague and lockdown is to measure our behavior against their behavior. And I feel in my community, at least the one I'm living in now, we fell short. We did not make the great gestures of self-sacrifice for the most part. We became quite selfish. I mean, our quarantine was don't come here, not we won't go there to save you. It was don't come here and contaminate us. So I was a little tiny bit disappointed that we didn't rise to our best selves as a community.
Okay, well, I'm just following on that kind of theme, or that revelation, I guess, that nothing really has changed. I actually was looking at when the novel was set, which is 1665, when the bubonic plague swept through England. But it was during the Restoration in the reign of Charles II when the strict puritanical rule was replaced by the more lenient Anglican Church dictates. So essentially the villages of Im had repeatedly experienced social crises with the challenging and overturning of monarchy and church, especially because Charles I had been executed, which would have been just incredibly distressing and shocking. The period was also marked by the Enlightenment, when advanced ideas of science and egalitarianism was creeping into society. Now, our modern world is also experiencing a period of rapid change, with people hardening their attitudes into opposing liberal and conservative camps. So I guess I'm trying to tease out whether, do you think the villagers of Im would have descended into superstition and punitive justice if there had been no preceding social upheaval? And why do you think some communities now respond to the concept of the common good positively, while others violently defy authority?
So I think you have to, you know, be very careful here, because we know the freight of all that history that occurred at that time. But did illiterate lead miners and shepherds living in rural villages, how much did it impact their life? So I think you have to be a bit forensic about that as a novelist and think, what affected them? What affected them most directly, I think, is not what happened to the king, but what happened in their parish church. And so they would have experienced quite a bit of upheaval in the order of their faith. And that was true in Im. We know that the more Puritan, for want of a more exact term, minister had been driven from the pulpit, but he still had quite a following in Im. And so a young minister had replaced him, who was more in line with the new Anglican order of service and with restoring, you know, some ritual and things that to us seem trivial, but were not trivial in those days, like where you put the communion rail and whether there was lace on the altar cloth, and all those kind of things were very contentious at that time. And so the lace had come back and the service had a more a more perhaps recognizable ornateness to it. And yet, you know, that division in the village was very real. And I think that one of the things that's most interesting is about is why the villagers were able to come to a consensus to quarantine and not flee and spread the infection was because the two ministers from the different different persuasions came together and agreed that this was the right thing to do, and together led the villagers to that decision. So how we're responding now, I'm not sure I can say anything definitive because we're still living through it, but I have to say it's been very telling to see how a society like Australia and a society like New Zealand, where the historical myth is that we're all in it together, the response has differed and been more successful, I think, than the United States, where it's all about being a rugged individual. Being a rugged individual is not a great thing to be in a time of plague, because this is something that affects everybody. And individuals making that choice to exercise their freedom just puts everybody at risk. And I think that's why the death rate has been so inordinate and so unnecessarily high in this country, as well as, of course, the inequalities of income and life circumstances here. But that is also fed by this, you know, notion of individual rights as opposed to community responsibilities.
Yeah, it certainly is amazing to see how different countries respond, and that's why I often feel, you know, is there something behind it in terms of their political and attitudes as a society, accepting government, of course, and America is certainly playing out what I think is the microcosm that you created in the Year of Wonders. It's kind of really on a large scale, but the difference there was that they actually did end up, you know, working for the common good and preventing the spread of the disease.
Well, that's true, and you know, there was, you know, the historical fact is no subsequent outbreak of bubonic plague was ever traced to the EM outbreak. So they saved, you know, perhaps hundreds of thousands of lives by their self-sacrifice. But as a result, you know, probably 2/3 of the villagers died, and many of those people would have saved themselves if they had fled. You know, so it was at great cost.
Yeah. A Year of Wonders showing people, you know, being both selfless and selfish, in their adversity. But I'd like to move on now to another book. You've got so many books, so I'd like to talk about Caleb's Crossing. It's also set in the 17th century, but in early America of the English Puritans, again, a puritanical period. You feature a young indentured woman, Bethia, and her interaction with Caleb, the first Native American man to graduate from Harvard College. You state in your afterword the book is based on a true story, but the history is limited in terms of documented sources. So I want to find out what challenges you faced in researching the book, and how did you approach writing a First Nations character?
So I live on Martha's Vineyard. It's an island. It's about 7 miles off the coast of Massachusetts. That's like, 12 Ks. And it still has an indigenous population who were never displaced, which is very unusual in the United States. The Wampanoag Indians kept their land and are still living here. So I had to be incredibly cognizant of the fact that I was writing about a member of the tribe. The tribe still exists here. They're my neighbors. I wanted to keep living here. So I approached it, you know, with great respect to the opinions of tribal members, but they all knew about Caleb. It's an extraordinary story. This is a young man who was raised in his own language and culture. And we're in the 1660s here, so it's before America is even a country. It's just a bunch of English settlers, colonists, who've arrived, and it's totally unclear whether their colonization will succeed or not. They're just a ragtag bunch of people, and the ones who came to this island are perhaps even more ragtag than most, because why would you put 8 miles of treacherous ocean currents between yourself and everybody else who's like you? And it turns out that they did that because they were trying to get away from the extremism of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Those people, having fled England looking for religious freedom, once they got here, wouldn't advance any freedom to anybody else. So the smallest divergence in doctrinal belief was punished severely. So in a way, the group of English settlers who came out here to Martha's Vineyard were atypical. And they were coming, about 30 or 40 of them, to live among perhaps 1,000 or 2,000 Wampanoag Indians. And they negotiated their existence here. And they bought the land that they settled on. And I'm not saying it was a love fest, and I'm certainly not saying there was no exploitation later. There was. But at the time of first settlement, the English were a very small band of people who were tolerated and of some interest to the native population, who wanted to understand these people. And so the chiefs sent their sons to be educated by the English, and one of them was Caleb. So he grows up in his own language and culture, but then he masters not only English but Latin and Greek, because in those days, to go to Harvard, you had to be fluent in Latin and Greek, because all the instruction was in those languages. So he was a considerable intellectual, but we don't know very much about what his experience was like. And the early records of Harvard are really scant as well. I went there, I'd set aside a month to be in the Harvard archive looking at 17th century documents. And the archivist comes to me the first day, and I'm there with my little cotton gloves and my pencil, which is all you're allowed to take in. And she comes with a manila folder, and it's this thin. And that was the entire 17th century archive of Harvard. There was nothing, because paper was scarce. Everything was scarce in those days. So I had to work around. I had to work around in every way. The one place where you can find a lot of information and actually hear people speaking in their own words is in court. And so the Massachusetts religious courts were an invaluable place to go and hear people expressing themselves, particularly women who, generally speaking, they could read, but they couldn't write, because reading was considered a good skill for women to be able to read their Bibles to their kids. But writing, you use that to communicate with people outside your family. So why would any good wife need to be doing that? So women weren't taught to write, but they were often being prosecuted for crimes like being a scold, which meant you were overheard criticizing a man in public. And I'm really glad that's not still a crime, because I'd be in the slammer and I think my
friends. I just scold's bridle on all the time.
One of my favorite court cases, actually, I relate to this woman across the centuries so clearly, because she's being accused of being a scold because the contractors that she'd employed to renovate her house had done a shoddy job, so she's out in the street yelling at them. I was so related.
Oh, dear. Well, so clearly lack of sources is always a challenge for an historical writer. So I'm going to pedal back even further millennia talk about what I would imagine was a great challenge when you're writing The Secret Chord. So it's about the biblical King David as related in the book of Samuel in the Old Testament. And you mentioned before that it was like, I love this expression, swan diving into the past. But I was interested why you decided to write a book set in biblical times where sources were like negligible. And what challenges did you face with like writing prehistory?
Oh God, I'm never do it again. it was, you know, you're looking at pot shards, actually. You know, it is a crazy exercise of the imagination. You have this unbelievably rich story, though, which is what sucked me in. It's not just Samuel, it's also in Kings and Psalms, and it's kind of scattered all through the Bible. You can make an argument that the entire Bible is about King David, because really the New Testament, Jesus takes his legitimacy from being of the house of David. So this guy is incredibly fundamental to Judeo-Christian Western thought, right? And every single thing happens to this man. He's the first biography we have in full, from soup to nuts, from the time he's a little child. We meet him, he's a child, and we follow him to his deathbed. And in between, he has the gamut of human experiences, the best and the worst, the most passionate love affairs, the most acid, absolutely excoriating hatreds from women who have once loved him, who turn against him, children who betray him, and then the child who is like the masterpiece of, you know, child rearing, who, you know, becomes king and has gone down as the epitome of wisdom and good governance, which is Solomon. But he's an outlaw, he's a hero, he's a poet, he's a warrior, he's a musician, he loves, he hates, he does wonderful things, he sins terribly, he kills brutally. I mean, he's just everything. He is the human experience. So that's why I was sucked into doing it. And then when I started to do it, I realized, outside of the Bible, this guy doesn't really exist. There's like one inscription that refers to him. You'd think if he really did control all this territory and all that, that, you know, the fairly literate neighbors in Egypt and Babylonia might have made a note of that, but no, there's nothing. So you're really in a deep dive into mythical territory, but you have to kind of think he must have existed, because nobody would make up such a flawed character as a national hero. Nobody would deliberately give their, you know, founding father all these flaws. So I was whipsawed. So what I did was a lot of physical research, which was go to all the places that are associated with him and do things that he might have done, like sleep under, you know, in a goat head tent in the Judean desert and herd sheep in the Shephala. And you can learn a lot from herding sheep, as it turns out. And there's a reason that most of the leaders in the Bible start out as shepherds. It turns out to be a really good career path to the C-suite.
So did you receive any backlash about writing about King David? Because
people were very annoyed with me indicating that his relationship with Yonatan was a sexual relationship, but I couldn't see any other way to read that. In the plain words of the text, you know, it's he states, David states that my brother Yonatan, your love for me was greater than the love of any woman. And they meet when Yonatan is already a young warrior and David's still quite a young boy. And it kind of fits the stereotype of the mentor mentee homosexual relationship that would have been common in that period in the Greco-Roman world. And so why wouldn't that have also been true of the Hebrew tribes, you know? So it seemed to me that if you hold the relationship up to scrutiny and your own lived experience, there's no other conclusion that you can draw. But some people found that, you know, I guess, you know, the more, I don't want to, how can I characterize it? The evangelical community thought that was pretty out there.
Yes, well, I think there's a misconception that the homosexuality was actually, it was more bisexuality, and there was that Erasmon and Orestes, beloved and lover relationships that occurred between men, which was more a mentoring role as much as anything within strict codes. So it did strike me that it may cause problems and backlash with the kind of thinking always in the black and white way. But is that also why you chose to make Natan the actual narrator rather than David himself?
Oh, no, I didn't feel like David would have enough insight into his own behavior to be the narrator. And I love that there are two references to this missing book of Nathan. So in the Bible, it says in two separate places that the acts of David first and last are told in the words of Nathan the prophet. And yet we don't have that book. And so I'm always intrigued by what we don't have, missing books, missing paintings, things that are described that don't exist anymore. And so that was what made me think that Nathan would be the ideal narrator, because he's the only one in the story who, you know, is in a position to see the whole picture. You know, you could see the women in the story are fascinating, but none of them is there for the whole span of the life. But we know that Nathan's there for a lot of it. And Nathan's there when David's on his deathbed, because it's Nathan who is intriguing with Bathsheba to try and get Solomon on the throne, even though he's a much younger son and there are older sons who have a better claim. But Nathan and Bathsheba want Solomon, and David accedes to that. So even after Nathan has confronted David and told him, you know, that he is a sinner and he's, you know, betrayed the trust of the nation in his actions, he somehow manages to survive that. You know, you don't usually make out too well on your retirement program if you tell kings that they really screwed up. But somehow Nathan does, and Nathan is the guy that David is still relying on when he's on his deathbed. So it was obvious to me that he should be the narrator.
Oh, good. So I'll just move on to the fact that you also are interested in writing multi-history novels like People of the Book, and that then places you with the challenge of dealing with multiple histories. So, you know, in People of the Book, you had Bosnian Wars, you had 1500s, you had the Nazi World War II. Which era is your favorite to research?
Oh gosh, whichever one I'm doing on the day, really. When I was doing People of the Book, I have to say it was really fun to go to Venice on a business trip. I love doing research in Venice because, you know, who gets to do that? And I had to research the angel hair pasta with the shaved truffle quite extensively, I found.
Definitely. Serious research. So, and I understand that you are writing, well, next year we'll get another wonderful book released. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's also a multi-history.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a braided story. It takes place in three time periods, and the historical spine of the story is inspired by the true story of an actually existing racehorse of the 1850s. And this horse was really, I guess, the foul up of his age. Although in those days, races were very different. They took place over 4 miles and they were heat races. So the horses would have to run 4 miles three times in one day. So this is a very different test of speed and stamina. So the horse was very celebrated. They actually invented the mass-produced stopwatch because people became so fascinated by this horse's fast times. And then the Civil War happens, and I'm not going to give too much away, but there's an interesting story of what happened to the horse during the Civil War. And then, so that's the historical spine of the book. And then there's a missing painting of this horse. Again, missing things. There's a painting that's described in great detail, but nobody knows where it is. And somehow that leads to New York in the 1950s and the abstract expressionist movement. And Jackson Pollock even comes into the story. And then there's a contemporary story about the horse's skeleton wound up in the Smithsonian Museum. And so there's a story about the science around researching the bones of this horse for what it can tell us about his speed and stamina. So the book is called Horse, which is easy to remember.
Yes. So when's it likely to be released next year?
It's coming out in mid-June.
Fantastic. Something to look forward to. There's been a few questions come in, and people can enter further questions in the Q&A. So I thought I might open up now and start asking you some questions. So the first one is, you mentioned using court transcripts to get a feel for the speech and language of the time. To what extent do you stick to that in your writing? In what ways do you compromise for modern reader comprehensibility?
Yeah, so going back to Year of Wonders, my characters would have been speaking in Derbyshire dialect. But if I had have written the whole book in Derbyshire dialect, probably nobody would have read it because it would have been too hard to understand. So in that case, you want to know how they sounded, and then you use that as seasoning to provide authenticity. But you have to be comprehensible to your reader. So I think that the right language is crucial, because I don't want to drag you out of the world that I'm trying to persuade you exists by using the wrong words. So in Caleb's Crossing, an example I really like is I needed Bethia to talk about a fetus at one point because she's doing midwifery. But I am totally certain that in Martha's Vineyard in 1665, Bethia is not using the word fetus. So what do you do if you haven't come across that in writing of the time? Luckily for me, there is a marvelous resource, which I think I have right here. I'll just show it to you. This is the Oxford Historical Thesaurus of the English language. And every historical novelist should have one. In this fantastic tome, you can look up the word fetus, and you can dig down to every word that has been used for that, all the way down to early Icelandic. So I go to fetus and I go down to 1650, and I find that the word she would have used is shapeling. And when you put the word shapeling in her mouth, it's kind of like time traveling. So for me, it's very important to get the words right. And I'm not bound by it, but I don't want to use words that were not in use. So I did make one mistake in Year of Wonders. I used the word mauve. I have her talking about the mauve tie to the heather. Well, the color mauve didn't exist in 1665. And I know that because a few years later, somebody wrote a book called Mauve. And it turns out it was another 100 years before we had mauve.
Okay, the next one I'm going to ask is actually about a book we haven't talked about, is March. The narrator in March is a tour de force, but never a comfortable read, being in his skin. I'd love to know more about your approach to unreliable narrators and the reader's responses to that.
Yeah, so March and Secret Court are the two books that I've written with a male narrator. And it's not instinctive for me, and it's not comfortable. But with March, it was inevitable because I wanted to write about an idealist at war, and in the Civil War period, that would have been a man. And then I thought of the absent father in Little Women, and he was the perfect found object to project this interest in what happens to idealists when they go to war for a cause that they ardently believe in and is morally right, like being anti-slavery was. But in the course of fighting a war, you do things that are morally abhorrent, and that happens in every war. And I wanted to explore that. And so March was a perfect vehicle to do it. And then I found out that Louisa May Alcott's father was this ardent idealist, abolitionist, vegetarian, animal rights activist, just an extraordinary progressive in every way. And he had written so much in his journals and his correspondence, and he'd been written about by people like Emerson and Thoreau, who relied on his thinking and forming their own moral positions. So there was just this wealth of material, which was such an unusual thing for me, because usually if you're writing historical novel with a female protagonist, you've got no written sources. You know, you are looking at court transcripts to hear her voice, because that's the only place you can find it. And here I had this like abundance. I couldn't shut him up. You know, it was just, so I had this perfect window into the mind of a Victorian idealist. Unreliable narrators. I think all of my narrators are somewhat unreliable. I think that makes it more interesting. I hope that readers get that you're not supposed to take everything that Nathan says on face value. I mean, is he really getting the word from God, or does he just think he is? And I always have somebody else in the novel putting the proposition that maybe he's not, maybe he is delusional. With Bethia, she's not really aware of what her true feelings about Caleb are. She tells herself a story about what they are, but there's an indication that there's more to it. So yeah, I'm always playing on that edge of, is what they're telling you, the reader, really what's going on? And I hope that the reader gets the sort of little frisson of pleasure in knowing more than the narrator knows.
Okay, the next one is, how do you reconcile different viewpoints and attitudes of the past with those of 21st century readers in your writing, for example, feminism and racism?
Yeah, no, well, I think you have to ask yourself this question every single time. How do you write about things that are not right? And I think you have to be, you know, you have to write about the ugliness that existed in the past, and you have to allow your characters to have these ugly thoughts. And you know, otherwise, you know, if you're just going to whitewash it, there's no point in writing historical fiction. The whole point of it is to take us back there. And live history forward the way they did, not view it backward the way we do. I mean, that's what historians do. They're allowed to view it backward. But if we're alleging and trying to bring the reader into what it was like to be them, then you have to be them for better and for worse. And you have to write about things that are not okay. I will do things to avoid offense, like in Horse, there is no way that people in that book, as I've written it, at that time would not have used the N-word, but I have chosen to not have anybody use the N-word in my book, because that word is just so ugly and painful. And if you can write around it, then I've chosen to do that. And that's a choice. In Caleb's Crossing, in the first edition, I used a word which I did not know, because my readers from the tribe had not pointed it out to me, but other tribal members found offensive. So in subsequent editions, I took that word out. So, but it doesn't mean that you don't write about the brutality of slavery. It doesn't mean that if you're writing about a rape, you don't write about the hideous pain and brutality of a rape. Otherwise, you know, don't bother, I think.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to actually combine two questions here because they're on the same theme or topic. First of all, have you received any feedback from Muslim readers, particularly women, and this is to not historical fiction, to the Nine Parts of Desire, but another attendee asked, how best have you found addressing, accepting, or ignoring backlash?
So the first question, yes, I got a lot of feedback, most of it very positive. Some negative. Nine Parts of Desire was, it's nonfiction book. It was based on my experiences as a journalist over 10 years, mainly in the Middle East, reporting in Muslim countries. And there was, you know, there was some hostility about a Westerner and whether it was Orientalism, and you know, some pushback like that. But mostly, I think women were pleased that they were heard. At that point, you know, there hadn't been a lot of opportunity. There'd been, you know, some really remarkable Muslim writers like Fatima Manisi, but Western audiences hadn't heard a lot from Muslim women themselves. And I did endeavor to let the women in the book speak for themselves, and generally speaking, I think that was appreciated at that time. There's been a lot more, obviously, you know, Muslim women writers publishing their own stories, which is, you know, infinitely better than having it transmitted through an observer. But at the time, I think it was worth doing. And the one that pleased me the most was that the Iranians really kind of adopted the book as a sort of talking point, and they translated large sections of it and published it in their main newspaper and had a kind of vibrant discussion about it. And I thought that that was very cool. So, yeah. The second part of the question, I've lost the
thread. With how do you best address, accept, or ignore backlash?
I think you just have to put your head down and do the work and do it the best you can. I mean, I listen and I try and hear feedback, but in the end, it's your work and you're responsible for it. So you can't let too many voices in that are going to stop you doing your work. At the point it's stopping you doing your work, I think you have to shut it down.
Okay, The next one is, how did you bump into the story for Horse?
Well, that is a kind of cool story, the story of the horse. I had been invited to a museum. It's called the Plymouth Plantation, and it's a very interesting kind of living history museum that tells about the Wampanoag Indians and the earliest English settlers in New England. And they actually have the kinds of houses that the English settlers built, and people are in character the whole time and they interact with you in character. And then there's an interpretive section, which is the Wampanoag giving their take on what happened during first contact. And so I'd been invited there to a lunch, and they were trying to pitch me to write a story about a young woman who had lived in that first English settlement. And I thought, well, that's very nice, except I just wrote that book. I mean, that woman is so similar to Bethia, and I can't go back and live in the head of a Calvinist woman for another 4 years. It's just, so I'm nodding and smiling politely as I'm picking at my salad. And then across the table, this representative from the Smithsonian Museum is visiting Plymouth Plantation, and he starts talking about how he just came from delivering this skeleton of this horse to the International Museum of the Horse in Kentucky, where it's going to be on loan. And he's telling the story of this horse. And I'm a horse fanatic. And so I sort of turned to my luncheon companion and said, essentially, could you shut up about that Puritan woman? I just need to hear about this horse. So that was how I got the idea.
Okay, so there's a couple of questions about people of the book. I'm going to try, there's quite a lot of questions, so I'm trying to kind of merge them, because I just to let everyone know, not everyone will have a chance to have their question asked. One attendee is asking about how you researched or your the people of the book, when you're, did you particularly like that because you could explore a book using an historical and mystical object?
For people of the book, I just found that the whole survival of this tiny little codex so fascinating, because when you see it, it's like it's about the size of a trade paperback. I mean, and it's got these dingy covers on it. And if you saw it in a box of giveaways by the side of the road, you probably wouldn't even pick it up. And then you do pick it up and you open it. And holy moly, the colors of the illuminations are just as vibrant as the day they were painted. And suddenly you're looking at this very familiar story to any Jewish person, the story of the Exodus from Egypt. But it's all set in medieval Spain. So Moses goes to confront Pharaoh, but Pharaoh looks just like a Spanish king. And the baby is put in the bulrushes, but the basket is sailing past medieval Spanish villages. And it's just this incredible object in itself. And then you realize all the different hands that had to pick it up and save it time after time when it was threatened. And it was always threatened by exactly the same infection that human beings are so susceptible to, which is otherizing. So, you know, the book is created during convivencia in Spain, when Jews and Muslims and Christians lived together and shared ideas and intellectual life, and Spain flourished as a result. But up comes this infectious idea that there's only one right way to be, and that's Christian. So all the Muslims and Jews are kicked out. But somebody saves the book. And then it's in Italy during the Pope's Inquisition. And again, there's just one way to be, but somebody saves the book. And then the Nazis, just one way to be. And a Muslim librarian saves the book. Anyway, it was a no-brainer to me. That story, just as soon as I learned the first thing about that book, I was hooked on that story.
It certainly is an amazing one. Another attendee has asked, what techniques did you have to use in your writing to stitch the different centuries through in the story? I mean, how difficult was it to weave this story and mystery?
It was so hard. So after Year of Wonders, I didn't, you know, at the time I wrote Year of Wonders, I had no idea if I could write a novel. But lucky for me, somebody wanted to read it, and then I got to write another one, and it was going to be People of the Book, but I couldn't do it. It was too much. There were too many different time periods, too many different characters. I had no idea what the connective tissue would be. I was really struggling with it. And then I got this idea, oh, idealists at war, Mr. March, 1 year, Civil War. I know how to do that book. So I put People of the Book in the drawer and I wrote March. And then, you know, so March has gone off to into production, and I have to open that drawer and take out what I had written for People of the Book and see if there was anything there. And I read it and I really liked it. And so then I had to really knuckle down and figure out how I was going to do it. And luckily for me, it was kind of a gift that I went to watch the actual conservation of this area, the Haggadah. And it was while I was sitting there watching the book conservator work that I realized how I was going to tie it all together, and that it would be by little artifacts that were in the pages of the book. And each artifact, piece of insect wing or a wine stain, would take us back to the time period. And then we'd return to the book conservator again. So that once I had that connective tissue, I had the way to do it.
All right. Now, everyone, I'm getting the chat as well, and they're all going, what was that book again? That's two tones. It's the Oxford Historical Thesaurus of English Language. Is that correct? Well, this is recorded, yes. So everyone will be able to, you know, rewatch, but just got that one in. How do you know when you've done enough research? This is the constant question that we all ask as historical novelists. How do you know when you've done enough research, and is your plotline outline worked out before you undertake the research?
So what I'm looking for is a story from the past that if you made it up, it wouldn't be interesting because it would be too implausible. So if I had said there's a Native American boy who's raised in his own language and culture, he learns Latin and Greek, goes and graduates Harvard in 1665 with the sons of the Puritan colonial elite. If I made that up, it wouldn't be interesting, but it's interesting because it happened. And because it happened, you've got a narrative arc that you're working within. If I had made up that a village quarantined itself voluntarily during bubonic plague, that wouldn't be interesting, but it's interesting because it's true. So because you've got that, you've kind of got your outline in the historical, the implausible truths of history. And then for me, I only do enough research initially to be able to hear a voice clearly who's going to tell the story. And sometimes it takes a long time to hear that voice, and sometimes it's almost instantaneous. Somebody just rises up out of the grave and just decides to start talking to me. And once I can hear their voice, how they sound tells me who they are, and who they are tells me how they'll act, and how they act sets the plot in motion. And then I start writing, and I let the writing tell me what I need to know So I don't go off and get mounds of information, because then I think the temptation is you've found out something really interesting about cooking in the 1650s and you're going to shove that interesting cooking thing in there, whether the story needs it or not. No, let the story tell you. So I'm writing away, and I know that Bathia is going to meet Caleb and he's going to be hunting waterfowl. Well, I don't know how Wampanoag hunted waterfowl, and I don't know what they were wearing when they did it. So then I go and find out, how did they hunt waterfowl and what was the traditional dress at that time? And then I can do enough detail, and then I can keep writing the next bit. So that's how I work. The research and the writing are like this the whole time.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It is a real challenge to don't disappear into the tar pit of research.
Yeah, because before I even started writing Year of Wonders, I met Charles Frazier, who wrote one of my favorite historical novels called Mountain. And he told this hilarious story about how he almost didn't finish that book because he loved going to the library so much, and he would just get lost down these rabbit holes of research, and he was getting no writing done. And then his wife, who is an accountant, said, "Chuck, I'm not going to let you go to the library anymore until you give me a list of three things you need to know. And you may go and find out those three things, but the rest of the time, I want you sitting at your desk writing this book." And that's how he finally got it finished.
Okay, now this is also, I think, something that authors agonize about. You mentioned about Mauve, you know, you've made an error in Mauve. Did you edit the next edition? I mean, is it enough to worry you that you want to actively do something to ensure that it is correct for the next edition? Or
I didn't bother with Mauve because I figured if it was something that was going to really distract people, I totally would fix it. So there's my dog just arrived and moved in. this is my dog. My dog. Hello, dog. I was reading a book once where they said the train stopped in Leominster. And I just happened to know there was no train in Leominster at that point. And that just really distracted me, because I thought, if I can't trust this author, you know, it just threw me out of the story. And so I think if it was something like that that was going to throw somebody out of the story, I would totally change it. But for Mauve, no, I just think it's kind of a funny story about how you can't be too careful and you can't assume.
And I think this will be the last one, because we are running out of time. And I'm conscious that there's all these forced closed in Zoom. So if that happens, I first of all want to say thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. And I know the chat stream has been going on here at the corner of my eye, and everyone has just loved hearing from you and your wisdom.
Well, look, I'm just really sorry we can't all be meeting in person somewhere, and I hope that will happen.
I very much hope so, that yes, that we will all be together. But the good thing about being worldwide in the web is actually there's more people that come and be able to come and listen to you. So thanks very much. So one last one is, you mentioned limited sources for Caleb's crossing, but what do you consider the definition of limited is? So you talked about, you know, you went to the Harvard archives and it was a manila folder, but what is your viewpoint about trying to access limited sources?
I would love to have more voices from the time and place. You know, the more voices that you can actually read who wrote something down, or who you can hear in a court transcript, or you know, just to be able to hear people talking amongst themselves from that time period, that to me is a richness of sources. But you don't want to have too much. I mean, if Caleb had kept a journal every day of his life at Harvard, then there'd be no room for a novelist's imagination. It would be a job for a narrative historian. So I guess that you're looking for that sweet spot where there's enough to create an empathetic imagined reality, but not so much that it crowds you out as a novelist.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's amazing to think you're over there in Martha's Vineyard and everyone else is in their own little rooms with their dog or cat. So that was lovely. What's her name?
Her name is Bear.
Bear. Okay. All right then. Well, thank you once again. It was wonderful.
All right. See you back in Australia.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, Summer Season 2023. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive where you'll find interviews with many illuminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.